Colonel Drummond, Reel 3. You were saying, Colonel Drummond, that you had to build these roads whilst you were on this Kajuri Plain campaign. What was the object of doing that?
Well, the object, I suppose, is the same as General Wade did in the Highlands between 1715 and 1745, or after 45, which was to open up the country so that you could get trade, so that the tribesmen, instead of coming down to raid, would come down and trade in the ordinary course of events. Also, I think the other reason was that if anything did happen, you would have roads where you could move people up and down, or soldiers up and down quickly. They were very rough roads. They were roads where you broke stones and put loose stones down, and then they were rolled in by steamrollers. There was no tarmac. And, of course, the tribesmen, the Freedies, used to go and find an Air Force bomb that hadn't gone off, and they'd go and put it in the road so it would blow a vehicle up. And so when we heard there was a bomb there, a whole brigade or battalion would be sent out to go and blow this thing up.
How often did that happen?
Oh, I think only about two or three times when we were up there. We were only up there for 3 months, and then the thing packed in.
What was your attitude towards the people you were fighting against?
Oh, we admired them very much. I mean, we always considered the frontier people to be very virile men and very hospitable men, and men for whom one had the very greatest respect, despite all that they did. They were people who one admired tremendously. Of course, they spent their whole time in war to them, or fighting with them, shooting with rifles, was a sort of game to them, the same way as football perhaps is to us. One man in his little fort, mud fort, possibly have a field with his neighbour, the fort was, say, about 300 or 400 yards away, and they'd spend the whole of their life trying to pot at each other and do it. And then one part of the Afridi tribe, or some part of the tribe, say they wanted to have a battle with another tribe, and they go to the district commissioner and say, we want to have a fighting battle with these particular people. And the district commissioner said, all right, so why did you don't cross this road or that road? You can have your battle in this particular area. When you finished it, well, that'll be that. And so fighting to them, really, was no more than playing their great sport, really. And I think when we produced the Maxim gun a long time ago, they sort of sent a deputation saying that this was really a bit unfair because they hadn't got anything like this, and this was really rather against the sort of rules of the frontier warfare. So I think one had an admiration for them.
Do you think that your admiration for them had anything to do with the fact that you were a Highland regiment yourself?
Oh, I don't think any. I think everybody in India admired them. I mean, Indian regiments as well. Because they were a very fine type of man.
So there was no sense of these people having led a similar type of existence in relation to the lowlands, to the existence traditionally that the Highlands had in the past to the lowlands of Scotland?
No, I don't. Well, they may have done amongst the local Indian population, but certainly not amongst the European population. I don't know what the Indians or regiments thought of them. I mean, the Sikhs obviously wouldn't have liked them, but I don't know what the other people thought of them.
Didn't you say that your particular regiment, the Seaforths, had some kind of blood feud?
Yes, we were supposed to have a blood feud with the Afridis, because I think in the Moman campaign of 1907, was it, we were supposed to have stripped their women or something like that. So the Afridis said, whether that's true or not, I don't know, but we got this information that we were supposed to have its blood feud with them.
Didn't they have some special name for you?
Well, I think the name for a kilt was Gugri, and we were known as Gugri Wallers, which was chaps in a kilt. Gugri, I think, was the sort of name for a pleated thing, a kilt at the back, as far as I remember. I think that's the Pashto for it.
Didn't you also tell me that there was an RAF officer captured at the time you were on this campaign?
Yes, one of the RAF officers was captured. And the Indian government gave, I think it was, or the RAF gave, I think it was about 3,000 rupees, speaking from memory, reward for his return alive. And so this chap is very well looked after. And as far as I can remember, some runner from the Afridis or go-between, or spice or people go-between, came running in and said he wanted some whiskey for the Saab who was captured. And so he was very well treated. I think any infantry soldier wouldn't have been so well treated.
Did they get that reward?
I don't know, I expect so, yes, because the chap was released. After all, I mean, Pilate was presumably a highly trained individual, and he was well worth this money, whereas poor infantry soldier wasn't.
Sorry?
I said, however, nobody was captured by them, so that, as far as anybody else, didn't arise.
What did you think would happen to you if you were captured?
Well, you would probably be put to death in a very unpleasant way by some mutilation, which was the sort of thing that happened, supposed to have happened to you. And one was always, you would fight an action to sort of save anybody, even if somebody who was dead to get his body back. You would fight an action, a rearguard action, or sit over the particular person if it was night, in order that you could get him back. I mean, you wouldn't, if you could possibly avoid it, you wouldn't allow anybody to fall into their hands. And then you were always supposed to keep, the old story is always supposed to keep one bullet out of your rifle for yourself in case you were captured.
And did you ever have to fight any of those rearguard actions?
No, we never did, no. No, because we never had anybody. I think we went out once, and I think two people were killed of the Indian regiments, but we were advancing, and so that one was advancing over their dead bodies, as it was, and so that there was no question of them falling into their hands.
So you never took any casualties yourself, then, in your...
No, we never had any casualties.
Were you fired on?
Well, okay, they came the first... when we arrived out there, there was on this Kajuri plain, near this village of Mirikel, which was where we were stationed, there was a jirga, fortunately, going on, which was a meeting, I suppose, between the district commissioner and the local chiefs of the Afridi tribe to try and patch up a peace or that they wouldn't go on doing what they were going to do. And so very fortunately, because we marched out from Peshawar in the morning, and then we halted, and then I think we went miles up into the RXI hills, which was a rather skeleton battalion headquarters and some signalling equipment. And then we got back to the place where we were going to build our camp rather late, I think about 4 or 5 o'clock. And so we didn't really have time to sort of construct a proper wall. And so thank goodness there was this jirga on, and so that there was peace. Otherwise, we might have been rather badly shot up. However, the next day we built our wall, and rather like the Roman camp, each man in a company, if we had 90 men in a company, you would build 90 yards of wall. And we started with headquarter company on our, marching with the company on our left, and we built our 90 yards of wall, and the next company, whose name I forget to us, started on their left, and they built whatever it was, their 120, 130 yards of wall, and there was a large gap between us where all the officers' lines were. And about 3 nights later, the Afridis came up in a party on a little hill on the opposite side where our latrines were, and shot up into the camp. And so the next day, the CEO was absolutely furious and said, this gap has got to be closed at once. And so we had to build a sort of wall, and he had a very high wall built around his tent. But that was the only time I think the camp was ever shot up. But then there wasn't really very much shooting, because these people were very elusive. And they don't have very much ammunition, and so they're apt to conserve their ammunition, and then they sort of shoot when they've got a suitable target. On the other hand, they do cut the nose... The sharp point off their bullet, the nose off their bullet, so it makes a worse wound. And so as a result, their bullets don't fly frightfully straight. So the chances of being hit if the jab aims at you was not very great from that point of view. Does that answer your question?
In view of the fact that they were cutting the noses off the bullets and...
Well, that's what we were told.
Yeah. Mm. But in view of the fact that you believe that they did this,
yes,
and that you believe the fact that... Mm. You would be tortured to death if you were captured.
Yes.
Did you didn't hate them?
No.
Because of these cruel things?
No, one didn't. No. One never thought these things had happened to you, never would be captured.
So there was no sense of fear of the British troops on these campaigns?
I don't think so. No. I mean, I don't know what other people felt. I have a terrible card, but I don't think I felt any particular fear on this account.
Didn't you say that the tribesmen rigged up a situation where they got the RAF bombing some clothes?
Well, this was supposed to be the story, was that the RAF used to go out, and these people used to live in caves, and they'd put their clothes out in front of the caves, and the RAF would bomb the clothes and think they'd done a lot of good, and then these people would come out roaring with laughter. That was, I don't know where that's drawn. That was one of the stories.
What kind of backing did you get from the RAF on this campaign? Was it satisfactory?
Well, they made a reconnaissance. Sometimes it fell down and some plane forgot to sort of come out. There was one occasion, I remember, when this happened, when we went out to a place called Elmkilly, I think it was, to go and blow up a bomb that they'd put in a road. And there were an awful lot of men on the far hill signalling away. And we reported this and said this was very odd. And we thought something very funny was going on. And actually, they were massing masses of men down below in a hollow below us. And this should have been spotted by this particular RAF plane, which was supposed to do reconnaissance, didn't turn up, because I suppose one could have put some artillery or something on it, but we didn't know what was happening. And then when we did retire, these people did open fire, and we did have a rather nasty time. But fortunately, some other brigade was out doing some ordinary exercise with its machine guns and saw this mass of people in the valley and were luckily able to open machine gun fire on it, which stopped it, which was very lucky. Otherwise, I think we'd have been in a very nasty situation. This was our whole of our brigade. So that this was really rather unfortunate.
Did you have to take any special precautions about varying your movements in a campaign like this?
Well, I don't think it really happened in this, but the rule of the frontier is that you must never go out, if you were going out on a walk or an expedition, you must never come back the same way. And when we were stationed as a regiment, either at Llandicoethal or Nowshera, I forget which, one of our best polo players, who was an 8-handicap major, went out with, I think, some other people on a walk from Llandicoethal, and they made the mistake of coming back the same way, and they walked out through their ambush, and they came back, and their ambush got them on the way back. So that you must do certain rules, and then if you're relieving a picket, if you put a permanent picket up on a hill, or it's a permanent picket somewhere or other, and you're going to relieve it, well, you don't know whether the tribesmen haven't come up in the night and scuppered your picket. And so that you've got to go up, and then you've got to attack your own picket, in case the enemy have got it. I mean, there are certain rules to the front that you must do, and there's two of them.
What did you do for a water supply on this expedition?
Well, there was the Barra River, which I think we had a pumping station at, and in order to supplement it, we got hold of a water diviner who potted about completely in a European water diviner, a complete sort of haze. At one particular point, he was seen heading with his funny stick way off in the direction of the Afridis, and was sort of stopped and brought back. And then the sap was drilled, and I think eventually, after getting some enormous depth, water was found. It was pumped up from this particular place and from the Barra River. And then in order to safeguard it, there was a picket on the hills overlooking this, my regiment, known as the water picket, overlooking this particular river, which guarded this particular supply. But I think generally speaking, and speaking from experience in Africa, water supply is a sort of thing that everybody wants, and water is an essential, and you don't go and poison or cut people's water supply off. It's just not done. So I don't think they'd have done anything to our water supply, because water is too precious to go and sort of squander about. I mean, we do have these unwritten laws that are sort of conventions, whatever you like it, and I think this was probably one of them. But I'm not an Indian Army. I mean, I only know this little bit of the frontier, so only talking of that.
I suppose that getting supplies to the troops on this expedition was a bit of a problem. I suppose that you had far less comforts.
And I think we were very well treated. No, because we had these big depots, K depot, which was full of tin stuff. I mean, one of the stories, I don't know how true, is that every 10 years or so you have a frontier campaign because these depots have got to turn their stock over. And so to have a frontier campaign, no, we were very well fed, and everybody was well fed. And everybody was terribly friendly. Really, it was very great fun, this thing.
So you didn't have any problems at all with the troops on a campaign like this? I mean, weren't they discontented with being cut off from female company or anything like that?
Oh, I don't think so, no. After all, it's three months. We got a Christmas leave into Peshawar. Oh, no, I don't think so. I mean, they were out in battle and everybody... No, because it was a great experience. No, everybody enjoyed it, I think. The majority of people did. I mean, it's obviously one or two didn't. No, I don't think so. Well, my company sergeant major came up, this is right off the point, he came up and he got most terrible indigestion, and he said, I've got this awful indigestion that I keep on having. And I said, "You don't seem to have many teeth, Sergeant Major, have you?" And he said, "No." He said, "I haven't." He said, "I've got one tooth down on this side of my mouth, the bottom, and one tooth up on the top." And he said, "I've left my false teeth behind in Jersey." So anyhow, he got sent a special message down, got his teeth back. But I think otherwise people were quite happy eating.
Didn't you say that you had a brigade photographer on that campaign?
Yes, we had an Indian chap who became a brigade photographer and really took extremely good photographs. But in order to show who he was, he got a bright blue band made well around his left sleeve with the words BF on it. It's a brigade photographer.
Can you tell me what the bungalows were like that you lived in whilst you were in India as officers?
Well, they varied. In Lahore, one lived in a sort of big mud mud house with a flat roof for coolness, and probably divided into four rooms. This would be in the cantonments, and each officer would have one room, and then he would live there and sleep there and sit there if he wanted to. But most of our activities, as I said, probably in the mess. Then when we went to Jhansi, I think the things were rather different. There were one, instead of having the bungalows, I think the bungalows for the married people, but instead of, this was for the officers, instead of having that, we had a long sort of low sort of building where you had two rooms. You had a bedroom and you had a sitting room, and then you had a bathroom, a ghusl khana. Of course, we had a tin bath. There were no slipper baths in those days or anything like that. And, of course, there was no air conditioning in those days. And so that, and there was no frigidaires. And so that you kept your drinks and things cool by having an ice box which you put things into. And although you had electric fans and electric punkers that swung in the barrack rooms, everything else was very primitive. Or you had a funny thing called a cask stati, which you put on a window, which is a sort of contraption of rather sort of grass-like stuff, which the beastie or the water carrier would throw water on. This probably in the barracks would throw water on, and then the air coming through the slits of this grass thing would be cooled by the water, and so you'd get a certain amount of cool air coming in.
Was it effective?
Oh, yes, extremely effective and very funny indeed, because if we didn't like some officer, we didn't like the second in command or somebody didn't very much, so they made a hole in it, and so when the beastie threw his water in, it went all over him.
How much of that kind of fooling about was there? How many pranks?
Well, there was a certain number. I remember somebody marched. This chap's mad keen on. Very nice. Everybody liked him, actually. But I think they did this to pull his leg, actually. Somebody marched. He was a very good horseman, very keen on horse. Somebody marched a horse backwards into his office when he was there, and the horse misbehaved itself, and everybody was very amused. But otherwise, I don't think there were a great number of pranks.
What about the food in India? Was it very much the same as in England or not?
Well, no. We used to have an awful lot of chickens, as far as the officers are concerned, which were terribly tough. No, and the meat was very much tougher. And I can't remember whether one had fresh vegetables from India or whether one was getting a bit muddled or whether one had them brought in. But no, the feeding wasn't so good and the eggs were much smaller and that sort of thing. And I should say it wasn't so good. And, of course, the troops had their ordinary rations, which were quite good, but I suppose not as good as you get at home.
So you didn't get much beef or pork?
I don't think one got pork. One got quite a lot of beef. Because there was a lot of cattle in India, so one got a lot of beef and that sort of thing. But I don't think it's as good as the beef at home, because the animals were much thinner, I think, much scraggier and tougher.
What about the quantity of food that you ate?
Well, I think one had, I think at home, I think generally one did seem to eat an awful lot. I don't know, one had sort of big dinners and big lunches. You didn't in the hot weather, of course, but you did in the ordinary day. But then I suppose one was working hard. I mean, one would have porridge for breakfast and then probably have fish and then eggs and bacon and perhaps toast and scones. But then I suppose one worked it out because one was leading an outdoor life the whole time.
And so was all the food English-style food? Did you never have Indian-style food?
I don't think so. One had curries occasionally, but no, I don't think one did, no.
So that really you were very unfamiliar with Indian cuisine when you left?
You're very unfamiliar, yes. I don't really know what the Indians did eat.
Did you ever go into an Indian's house to have a meal with them?
No, never. I didn't. I don't know anybody else did. I certainly didn't.
And what about the arrangements in the mess for financing the mess? Can you describe how the mess was financed?
Well, I suppose it was financed. You paid so much extra for your food was divided out between everybody. And then you paid your own drinks and for your own cigarettes and things that you bought and smoking mess. That was, well, that you paid for yourself. And then you obviously had various subscriptions for the mess silver fund and the mess wedding fund and, you know, so much towards your newspapers and things. And then you had mess meetings to decide what people wanted and what they didn't want. Does that answer your question?
And in these mess meetings, could you speak freely, or?
Oh, yes, I think, yes.
So you weren't inhibited from expressing your point of view by rank?
Oh, no, not at all, no.
Who was the chairman of the meetings?
Well, I suppose, in all the army, we had a person called the president of the mess committee who ran the mess, and underneath him you had a messing officer who was responsible for the messing, and you had a wines officer who was responsible for the wines, and you possibly had another officer who was responsible for the general condition and cleanliness and so on of the mess, which was in addition to your ordinary duties. And so the messing officer would produce the food and go into with the cook and sort of try to keep the price down and that sort of thing. And then, of course, as far as the troops are concerned, the orderly officer used to go around and inspect the rations. And if the meat was bad, which it sometimes was, he'd send for the medical officer or so and condemn the meat, and then they'd have to open bullied beef or something. Sometimes this happened. And then at lunchtime, at dinners, you would go around as the orderly officer and ask if there were any complaints from the men about their food, and if there were, you would take note of it and try and get it sorted out. There very rarely were any complaints. I think we as a regiment used to try to feed our men rather well. I remember, not in India, but when I was at my depot in 1932 to 1934, 1933 to 1935, this army chap at the depot wrote home to his parents and said, "This is marvellous life at the depot. There's knife and fork work at each meal." So I think we did try and feed the people well. But then they're very conservative soldiers. If you gave them salads and beautiful stuff, they'd probably say, "No, we much prefer to have cabbage and stuff. We don't like this." Although they'd prefer to go and pay a great price to eat it in a restaurant. Well, I mean, they weren't in restaurants in India, but I think they were quite well fed.
How much drinking of alcohol was done in India by the officers?
I don't think unduly. I think it was considered to be a good thing to have a whisky or so at night, but not in excess. And I think it was always considered to be a good thing to drink as much liquid as you could, not alcohol, because I think it helped keep malaria down. And so that no one wasn't encouraged to drink.
But you had wine with your meals, did you?
No, I don't think one did, actually. No, I think that on an ordinary guest night, you passed the port round. I don't know what one drank. One drank various things with one's meals.
Did you dress for dinner?
Oh, yes, every night. Oh, Lord, yes, you put on a mess kit every night. Well, I mean, that was the same as, I suppose, at home. I mean, people always dressed for dinner in their dinner jackets and things. So I don't think that was anything very extraordinary. And you dressed on the boat going out, too.
And was the dress for the guest night different, or was it the same?
No, on an ordinary night, you wore your trousers and Wellingtons and your Saxony tartan waistcoat and your black bow tie and or white mess jacket. And then on guest nights, if it is a regimental guest night, you wear your full diced Mingus hose with your garters and your skin do and your Saxony kilt and your sporran with its gold tassels and your white mess jacket. And then on an ordinary guest night, where you had your own guests, I think you again wore a Saxony kilt and presumably your sporran, but I think you probably wore different stockings. I think there was a slight difference.
How often did you have a guest night?
I don't think any more than about, I really can't remember. I don't think more than about sort of one a month, and perhaps a regimental guest night about once every 3 months or something, or may have been more often. That was when you asked regimental guests. The CM would ask his regimental guests and he wouldn't be allowed to ask any other guests. And they'd be paid for by the out of the mess funds by everybody. But if you had an ordinary guest night, you could ask your own guest and you'd pay for him yourself.
Was there a lot of mess tradition and ceremony in your regiment?
I don't think more than any other regiment.
Were there any special toasts or anything of that kind?
Well, you drank the Queen's health. I can't remember they drank the Queen's health every night, but that was a very simple ceremony. I mean, the port was passed round and everybody filled their glass of port, or if you happened to be a regimental guest night, or people were drinking champagne, would pass champagne round, because champagne and port don't mix, because you get a nasty head in the morning. And then when everybody had it, the PMC would sit at one end of the table and the orderly officer, I think, at the other end. PMC would merely get up and say, Mr. Vice, because he'd be the vice president of the mess, Mr. Vice, the king. And then the vice president would get up and everybody else would get up and he'd say, gentlemen, the king, and then everybody drink the king's health and then sit down again. And then you were allowed to smoke cigarettes, was I remember, after that.
And did you have regimental silver on display?
Yes. Then, of course, you'd have your pipers that come in after you'd drunk your port, and they first of all go around the mess table. Each company commander would have a pipe banner, and his company piper would carry his pipe banner on his pipe, which is a big sort of banner with the company commander's crest on one side and the regimental crest on the other. And they would play a march and perhaps a Strathspeyan reel and then go out. And then the pipe major would come in and play a pibroch, which would go around. And he used to go round and round the table, and we as subalterns would have bets as to how many laps at the table he'd do before he stopped. And then when he came to the climax, this is terrible for me to say this, when he came to sort of the end of the piece and played the piece which was sort of a whole lot of grace notes in it, he'd stand behind the CA's chair and play the sort of final part of the pibroch. And then he'd go out, and then he'd come in, and the CA would give him a quake, which is a little sort of wooden cup with two sort of handles on either side, fill up a quake with whiskey. And then he'd give the Gaelic taste, which is quite a long thing in Gaelic. And then he'd drink it down, and then he'd go out again. And then they'd all come in again, and they'd again play a march, Strathspeyan reel, and go out. But as Stuart of Garth says in his book, really, the pipes are meant to be played out of doors and not indoors. So that would go on, and so that the whole of your guest night would really take quite a long time.